It's 100 years since Nessie on the Moses of Michelangelo, the statue that dominates the tomb of Pope Julius II, was published anonymously in the psychoanalytic journal Imago. Its author, who came to follow the literature of psychoanalysis closely, compared the emotive power of the inscrutable masterpiece to that of Shakespeare's Hamlet. Using a method he compared to psychoanalysis, which had traced the effect of Shakespeare's tragedy to the Oedipus complex, the anonymous author set out to explain the effect of Michelangelo's statue. It was only later that the responsibility for this essay, A Non-Analytic Love Child, was admitted by the father of the psychoanalytic movement, Sigmund Freud. When in Rome, Freud's interest in the Moses had drawn him habitually to the Basilica of San Pietro in Vincoli, which houses the papal tomb. How often had I mounted the steep steps to the lonely piazza where the deserted church stands? These days the church is seldom deserted. But Michelangelo's contemporary biographer, Giorgio Vasari, tells us Moses had always been a crowd puller. According to him, Freud's solitary path was well-worn by the incongruous tread of Jewish pilgrims. And well may the Jews go as they do every Sabbath, men and women flocking like starlings to visit and adore the statue, since it is not something human but divine that they adore. The story has not bring to it, to say the least. What business of these Jews visiting a papal tomb on the Sabbath or any other day? And what were they doing adoring a graven image such as the law of Moses expressly forbids? Taking the imaginary perspective of the Jews in Vasari's story, we are reminded that to admire Michelangelo's statue is to confront a paradoxical embodiment of the image prohibition contained in the Decalogue or Ten Commandments that Moses received from God at Mount Sinai. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them nor serve them. Although the essence of Mosaic law is shared by the Jewish and Christian religions, the former adheres usually to a stricter sense of the image prohibition, particularly with regard to sculpture or graven images. The reason for this seems readily apparent. Since Christianity embraced an idea of God incarnate, and the corporeality it implied, the effect of the image prohibition was inevitably reduced. Judaism, by contrast, continued to recognize it as safeguarding the singularity of an invisible and immaterial God. The contrary attitudes to the image prohibition that prevail in Judaism and Christianity, most consistently in the Roman Catholic Church, evince a fundamental religious difference, one that is trespassed entirely by the Jews in Vasari's story. What Vasari describes, no less than a Jewish image cult of Moses, seems to epitomize the Freudian concept of the return of the repressed. That is, the inexorable rule by which repressed psychic or cultural material, in this case idolatrous worship, re-emerges through the very agent of repression, here the forbidding figure of Moses himself. The concept is most engagingly illustrated by Freud in his analysis of Willem Jensen's short novel, Gradiva, a Pompeian fantasy. In the same essay, Freud elaborates the archaeological metaphor that he used to introduce his vision of psychoanalysis to his patients. And I think he directly invoked these many antique figurines that populate his consulting room. These important Freudian ideas, repression, recurrence, and the metaphor of archaeology, have, I suggest, unexploited potential as tools of understanding not only the special case of Michelangelo's Moses, but Renaissance art and culture in general terms. That Freud himself failed to develop this understanding in his Moses essay only testifies to the strength of his ulterior motives in writing it. The subject of Freud's essay, Michelangelo's colossal marble figure, was blocked out 400 years earlier, 1513, and took some 3 decades to finish. It was conceived as part of a huge monument comprising over 40 statues. When finally Pope Julius' tomb was completed in 1545, it was a shadow of those grand designs. Among the 7 figures contained in the finished monument, Moses has always stood out as a singular masterpiece. For Freud, the strength of feeling that Michelangelo's statue aroused in him could be explained, if not diminished, by analysing its meaning or narrative content. In those days, it was generally agreed that Michelangelo represented Moses on his first descent from Mount Sinai, the 2 tables of law freshly inscribed by the finger of God. Having been warned that the people had fallen into idolatry, he heard their singing from the mountain. But as he approached the camp, he saw the golden calf they had made, and the dancing, and Moses' anger waxed hot, and he cast the tables out of his hand and broke them beneath the mount. On Moses' orders, the Levites then killed 3,000 of the faithless people. Sometimes, Freud tells us, I have crept cautiously out of the half-gloom of the interior as though I myself belonged to the mob upon whom his eye is turned. A mob which can hold fast no conviction, which has neither faith nor patience, and which rejoices when it has regained its illusory idols. Freud, however, contested the view that Moses was about to rise and dash the first tablets to the ground. Instead, he imagined an apocryphal Moses, one superior to the biblical one, who managed to conquer his passionate impulse. He remembered his mission and for its sake renounced the indulgence of his feelings. There are serious problems with Freud's analysis, not least the total distortion of the biblical account. But although he described his attempt to analyse the statue as a fun, it was not one to be taken lightly. His intimate biographer Ernest Jones related the essay's content to the events of the Psychoanalytic Congress of 1913, where it became clear that Jung was following other disciples of Freud into apostasy. The Moses of Michelangelo was written later that year. For Jung and his fellow apostates, the anonymous voice, mosaic, yet unmistakably Freudian, must have struck a chord. Were they that errant mob, which could hold fast no conviction, possessing neither faith nor patience? Emulating the heroic restraint of his Moses, Freud would not allow full vent to his wrath. However, by publishing his pretentious article in Imago, he was guaranteed the audience of his errant acolytes. Anonymity can be a very thin veil. Nowadays, most scholars dismiss narrative readings of Michelangelo's statue, which is usually seen as a timeless portrait of the lawgiver. A view that accords with that of Michelangelo's approved biographer, Ascanio Condivi, who describes Moses as in the attitude of a contemplative thinker. Even so, Condivi, like Freud, felt a pronounced ambivalence towards the statue. Observing that its face, full of vivacity, spirit and vivacity, is apt to induce both love and terror, as might have been true of Moses himself. This attitude epitomizes Michelangelo's classic impression of divinita and terribilita. Vasari likewise saw Moses as a holy and most terrible prince. To him, the statue's face in particular appeared so splendid and dazzling that he suggested a veil to cover it. Vasari deliberately evokes Moses' second descent from Sinai, bearing two tablets to replace those he had broken in anger. On the second descent, Moses appeared so transfigured from his encounter with the Lord, the children of Israel were afraid to come near unless he wore a veil. This episode gained a particular significance for Christians, who saw the broken tablets as prefiguring the abrogation of the Jewish covenant, and the second tablets as prefiguring the new universal covenant of Christ. The Jews' inability to look at the glory of God reflected in Moses' face was described by St. Paul as a metaphorical blindness, one that for Christians underlay the Jews' literal aversion to images. What Vasari imagines, then, is a recurrent Damascene moment, the Jews overcoming their biblical blindness when they come to visit and adore the statue of the fearsome iconoclast. Still, the memory of the apostasy at Sinai could not be shaken, and views of Michelangelo's Moses remain polarized. Some, like Vasari, see the statue's face as reflecting the glory of God, others the abomination of the golden calf. At the entrance to Freud's study at Merciful Gardens, downstairs, hangs a plaster copy of Willem Jensen's Muse, an excavated Greco-Roman bas-relief representing a young woman in full-length profile. As she walks, she raises her gown lightly in her hand to reveal her sandaled feet. Jensen's story concerns a young German archaeologist, Norbert Hanold, who, in spite of his complete indifference to the female sex, becomes mysteriously infatuated by the girl in the bas-relief. Having acquired a cast of the sculpture for his study, as Freud would, Hanold becomes particularly enthused by the girl's elegant manner of walking. He names her Gradiva, she who walks splendidly. Under the pretext of scientific inquiry, the archaeologist discovers a keen interest in the feet of his female contemporaries. Now, the young man notices a fantasy which places a living Gradiva in Pompeii before the eruption of Vesuvius. The author describes a vivid anxiety dream, wherein Hanold is transported to Pompeii on the day of its destruction. Here he witnesses Gradiva's death and petrifaction. From Vesuvius, the red glow flared over her countenance, which was with closed eyes was exactly like that of a beautiful statue. Thus, Gradiva is buried by the rain of volcanic ashes. In waking life, an unconscious compulsion leads Hanold to the excavated ruins of Pompeii, where he seems to encounter the Gradiva of his fantasy. However, it emerges that this girl, who so closely resembles the bas-relief, is no Greco-Roman phantom, but a living German girl. Moreover, she is, as reader and hero discover simultaneously, none other than Hamel's childhood playmate, Zoe Burtgang, the forgotten object of his repressed eroticism. In Pompeii, the scene was set quite perfectly for this kind of psychological excavation. Indeed, remarked Freud, there's no better analogy for repression, which at the same time makes inaccessible and conserves something psychic, than the burial which was the fate of Pompeii and of Zoe Gradiva, and from which the city was able to rise again through the work of the spade. And this is an image that Freud used to illustrate the concept of repression, the inevitable return of the repressed. There's an ascetic monk who's trying to avoid carnal temptations by contemplating the crucifix, which is transformed before his eyes into a voluptuous naked woman. In terms of Freud's analysis, the fate of Jensen's hero exemplifies the inevitable recurrence of repressed material. He uses the case of Hamel to remark on the typical manner of such recurrence, which is accomplished as if by malicious treason, the very thing which has been chosen as a means of repression, in Hamel's case archaeology, becomes the carrier of the thing recurring, his love for the light-footed Zoe. In and behind the agencies of repression, the repressed material finally asserts itself victoriously. Moreover, Freud reckoned that we, like Jensen, have a good right to linger over the significant resemblance between a bit of psychic occurrence in the individual and a single historical event in the history of man. Freud extended this analogy to the history of religion, and particularly the development of Judaism and Christianity. In his apocryphal history of the Jews, Moses and Monotheism, which was published just before his death here in London, he argues that the religion of the biblical Hebrews was given to them by an Egyptian prince named Moses, who had been inspired by the short-lived monotheism of Pharaoh Akhenaten IV. After the Pharaoh died, his subjects reinstated their sundry gods, but Moses identified the Hebrew slaves as potential monotheists, if only he could be put out of bondage. Thus Freud explains the unusual conception, one peculiar to Judaism, of a god choosing a people, as opposed to a people choosing a god. The undistorted truth, Freud suggests, is that the Jews were the chosen people of Moses. To exorcise the Hebrews of their own Egyptian polytheism, Moses imposed upon them a religious doctrine which was systematically antithetical to it. As well as the denial of an afterlife, Moses' monotheism prohibited all visual representation of its god. Whether or not one subscribes to this idea of the Jews as the chosen people of Moses, their unique monotheism must, as Freud suggests, have relied on a doctrine of antitheses. The Egyptologist Jan Assmann identifies clearly what monotheism entailed as a distinction between true and false in religion, a distinction that did not exist in the world of polytheism. Because polytheism, like polygamy, does not imply exclusivity, it permits the sort of intercultural translation exemplified by the ancient Greek and Roman religions, where Jupiter is equivalent to Zeus and Venus to Aphrodite. Monotheism could not allow the same, because false gods cannot be translated. What Assmann calls the mosaic distinction creates a new type of religion that rejects everything that went before and is outside itself as paganism. This primary distinction came to underlie further ones between Jews and Gentiles, Christians and pagans, and eventually Catholics and Protestants, Calvinists and Lutherans and so on. But in cultural memory, the original mosaic distinction is represented by the opposition of Israel and Egypt and illustrated by the grand narrative of Exodus. Egypt thereby came to symbolize the rejected, the religiously wrong, the pagan, and Egypt's most conspicuous practice, the worship of images, came to be regarded as its greatest sin. The basic antitheses of the mosaic religion related to polytheism and image worship are expressed by the first two edicts of the Decalogue, or Ten Commandments. No false gods and no images. Two edicts that cannot be easily separated, even in literal terms. And there is a loss of, there's been a huge amount of ink spilt over the division of the Ten Commandments, whether what is known as the Second Commandment against images is in fact an adjunct to the first, or whether it's a discrete commandment. As Freud saw it, the mosaic image prohibition had implications beyond preserving the monotheistic ideal. The dematerialization of God marked a triumph of spirituality over the senses, instilling in the Jewish people a preference for spiritual endeavor that set them apart from other nations. For Freud, The subsequent triumph of Christianity also marked a progress in the history of religion, that is to say, in regard to the return of the repressed. According to him, not only did the Christian religion rematerialize the Jewish God, it turned out not to be strictly monotheistic. It took over from the surrounding peoples numerous symbolic rites, re-established the great mother goddess, and found room for numerous deities of polytheism in an easily recognizable disguise, although in subordinate positions. In this rather generalized view of Christianity as a form of polytheism, the fact of its initial emergence as a Jewish sect is understood to signal the return of the repressed within Moses' monotheism. Freud, however, elides the fact of Christianity's own direct opposition to polytheism. After all, its triumph in late antiquity was achieved at the expense of the gods of ancient Rome. The Christian supersession of ancient polytheism is essential to understanding Italian Renaissance culture, which attempted to reconcile the virtues of Christianity with those of classical antiquity. The result may be described in Freudian terms as a compromise formation, in which a repressed and a repressive trend both find an incomplete expression. According to the Freudian tenet, religion demands later the introduction of any forbidden thing in altered form, while it bitterly converts it in undisguised form. The idea is well illustrated by the antics of Pope Sixtus V, late 16th century Pope, who declared war on pagan idols, exorcised the ancient columns of Trajan and Marcus Aurelius, and surmounted them with bronze statues of St. Peter and Paul. And I think perhaps Alexander Pope was thinking of Trajan's column when he wrote these lines, which also seem to encapsulate the Freudian idea of the return of the repressed in relation to the Renaissance. See the circle, the unpenitent temple moss, street paved with heroes, Tiber choked with gods, till Peter's keys and christened Jove adorn, and Pan to Moses lends his pagan horn. In 15th century Florence, the sculptor Lorenzo Ghiberti lamented the destruction of idols under Constantine, the emperor who embraced Christianity 1,000 years earlier. As Ghiberti imagined it, the official persecution of idolatry resulted in the total destruction of art itself. The temples were rendered bianchi, white or bare, in which base condition they would remain for centuries. Ghiberti's sentiments are echoed by Vasari, who identifies the primary cause of the perceived decline of the arts in the medieval period as being the zeal of a new Christian religion, which suppressed and abolished the old faith of the pagans. In the effort to remove and utterly extirpate the smallest things from which errors might arise, not only were the marvellous statues, sculptures, pictures and ornaments of the false Gentile gods cast down and destroyed, but also the memory and honour of countless excellent persons. In the passage that seems to anticipate Freud's archaeological metaphor for repression, Vasari describes how the admirable sculptures and paintings buried in the ruins of Italy were inaccessible or unknown to men engrossed in the rude productions of their own age. What Vasari would call the rinascita, rebirth or renaissance, of the arts in Italy was epitomised by the excavation of antique statues. A defining moment in Renaissance archaeology was the unearthing of the Laocoon group in a Roman vineyard in 1506, an event witnessed by Michelangelo soon after he received the commission for the papal tomb. The influence of the excavated image of Laocoon and his son's death by sea serpents is evident in the three figures Michelangelo began for the 1513 tomb project, of which the Moses was one. The so-called dying slave recalls the lethargic struggle of the younger son, while the rebellious slave resembles the more vital older son, whose efforts to escape the serpent's coils are unabated. There's something of Laocoon himself in the huge muscularity of the seated Moses. Having witnessed for himself the excavation of his locus classicus, Michelangelo, it may be said, had enjoyed a first-rate archaeological therapy. The Italian interest in excavated statues had been aroused much earlier than Michelangelo's time, but the effect at first was not entirely therapeutic. Ghiberti recounts the legend of a statue attributed to the Greek sculptor Lysippus that was unearthed in Siena around 1340, so more than 150 years before Moses, and sought a great acclaim on the city's central fountain. The statue was admired by local sculptors and painters, who soon blamed for Siena's misfortunes in war with Florence. The biblical prohibition against idolatry was invoked, the statue broken, and his thesis superstitiously reburied, this time on enemy soil. The citizen's fear of the perils of idolatry, effectively repressed for as long as the idol remained buried, is in contrast to the artist's aesthetic appreciation of the statue and Ghiberti's regret for its loss. The example of pagan art would eventually reinvigorate the Christian image-making of Ghiberti and his contemporaries. In the process, the once anathemized symbols of polytheism appear to have undergone a sort of rehabilitation, or a phenomenon that the art historian Michael Camille described as the renaissance of the pagan idol. As Florence sought to reinvent itself as a new Rome, the city's preeminent sculptor Donatello made what was arguably the first freestanding bronze nude since antiquity. The statue of David, the Jewish giant killer, stood in triumph on a column, formerly the preserve of pagan idols. In an ominous echo of the affair in Siena, Donatello's totemic Judith, another Old Testament idol, would be blamed for Florence's misfortunes in war. In this case, however, the offending statue was neither broken nor buried, but was replaced outside the town hall by Michelangelo's gigantic new David, a figure more Greco-Roman god than Jewish shepherd boy. For art historians, it is often unclear whether these antique-inspired marble and bronze statues were persistences of pagan cult statuary, or rather self-conscious references to what has been called the iconography of idolatry. That kind of self-consciousness is exhibited by Vasari in his life of Donatello, when he imagined the sculptor chiding his own lifelike statue of the Hebrew prophet Haggab Habakkuk, "Speak, speak, or may you shed blood," a challenge to the prophet himself, who condemned dumb idols and declared, "Woe unto him who speaks to them." This exaggerated awareness of idolatrous appearances betrays, I suspect, an underlying anxiety related to this kind of image-making, an anxiety heightened in Vasari's time by the image wars of the Reformation. From the early 16th century, the Protestant challenge to the corruption of the Church in Rome brought with it an iconoclastic threat of a magnitude not previously felt in Western Christendom. Those reformers most hostile to images, statues in particular, wanted to restore churches to that state of whiteness disdained by Ghiberti. Although a range of views on images existed among Protestant and Roman Catholic reformers, most addressed religious art as a central concern, and some espoused total iconoclasm. Protestants notably reprised the Judaic taboo against representing God the Father in human form, which had never been so fully compromised as it was in Renaissance Italy, and in particular by the divine Michelangelo. And the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Five representations of God the Father in complete human form. I could digress somewhat about this image, but the Jewish resistance to figuration has a lot to do with the idea that the creation of man in Genesis, the idea of God creating man in his own image and likeness could be inverted, and man ends up creating God in his image. These anxieties about image-making and the peril of idolatry were not altogether new. The Reformation only intensified concerns that inhabited and occasionally inhibited Christian art. A common practice in medieval Christian culture was to project such anxieties onto visible others, Muslims and especially Jews, from whose religion Christianity emerged, and whose precarious survival in Christian lands depended on their role as witness to those origins. For example, Christian doubts about the efficacy of transubstantiation were assuaged by stories of Jewish host desecration, understood by simple Christians to be credulous reenactments of deicide. Similarly, concerns about the cultic use of images were projected onto Jews, who were accused not only of iconoclasm, but also idolatry. Certainly the most recognizable image of idol worship in medieval Christian art is the adoration of the golden calf, in which the biblical idolaters are conflated with contemporary Jews by their distinctive medieval costumes. They are here, they're wearing the pointed hats that the Jews were forced to wear by an edict of the church from the early 13th century to mark them apart from Christians. And this is a very common juxtaposition of Moses receiving the law from God, who appears as in the form of Jesus Christ. And even while he's receiving the law, the Jews are breaking it in the lower image. It's a remarkable the extent to which Jews and Judaism feature in Roman Catholic and Protestant polemics of the Reformation era. The term Judaizing is used on both sides of the debate to frame a concept of religious error that all Christians could understand. Seen in this light, the Sari story of the Jewish starlings flocking to Moses invites a more cynical reading. Among the most aggressively iconoclastic reformers, the Wittenberg theologian Andreas Karlstadt had already conjured an image of birds flocking to idols, flying in the face of the Mosaic prohibition. But his ravens were Roman Christians, who seemed to him like the faithless biblical Jews. This is one light in which, surprisingly, neither Michelangelo's statue nor Vasari's story has been properly considered. The traditional accusations of Jewish idolatry did not, for obvious reasons, involve images made for Christian consumption. On the contrary, Jewish attitudes towards Christian images were historically portrayed as iconoclastic, as evidenced by allegations of image abuse in Florence and Mantua as recently as the 1490s. Vasari's inversion of a popular libel formula suggests a further topical connection with counter-Reformation efforts to convert Italian Jews. These efforts began in earnest in 1543 with the founding of a conversionary institution in Rome that the Jews themselves were forced to finance. This was followed by the Jews' confinement to ghettos in Rome, 1555, and Tuscany, 1571, and later their compulsory attendance of conversionary sermons in Rome, Florence, and elsewhere. In view of this historical context, Vasari's fiction has been read as a metaphor for Jewish conversion. By turning to the forbidden image of the lawgiver, the Jews, as one art historian put it, turned away from their laws and turned towards Christ. In this apparent case of malicious treason, to paraphrase Freud, we recognize the typical manner of the return of the repressed. As I will argue, the idea of Moses betrayed by his own image is inherent in Michelangelo's statue and advertised by his use of a particular motif. I remarked on the common attitude of ambivalence towards Michelangelo's Moses and related to the religious paradox of the figure embodies. Such an affect, however, cannot derive solely from religious sensitivity, as suggested by a body of secular art historical criticism. Michelangelo's 19th century English biographer, John Addington Symonds, while admiring the figure, admitted that we may not be attracted to it. Indeed, we may even be repelled by the goat-like features, the enormous beard, ponderous muscles, and the grotesque garments of the monstrous statue. Symonds wondered how Michelangelo's contemporary, Condivi, who felt only love and terror before the statue, did not feel the turbulence and carnal insolence which break our sense of dignity and beauty now. Since the early 18th century, the Moses, which had always been praised without reserve, began to attract the sort of disparaging remarks that Symonds made. The figure's beard, which Vasari commended for its beauty and technical virtuosity, was described as excessive, the sleeveless tunic and brawny arms likened to those of a baker or a galley slave. Symonds' first assessment, however, that there is something goat-like about the Moses, is the one that recurs most frequently in the literature of the 18th and 19th centuries. In the opinion of the English painter Jonathan Richardson, this Moses has so much the air of a goat that either Michelangelo intended it, or he mistook his air, and instead of raising it to the top of human nature as he ought, has sunk it towards brutality. Likewise, the Victorian critic William Watkiss Lloyd, whose monograph on Moses would be especially of interest to Freud, suggested that not only the form of the head, but the movement given to it were Capron. It seems unlikely that these writers would have identified the form of the head and thereby thought of its movement as Capron, goat-like, were it not for the pair of horns that protrude from the hair above the prophet's brow. For Symonds, the horns were so essential to the repellent or monstrous effect of the statue that they went without saying. But remove the horns, and his allusion to goat-like features would demand some elaboration. Properly examined, the horns do not even look especially Capron, let alone do they compare to those of a mature goat. I'll consider how they compare to the horns of other animals shortly, but I suggest that the reason for an enduring association with goats is this image of a horned and heavily bearded man brought to mind another creature both hirsute and notoriously horny, namely the satyr. These mythical hybrids, once horse-tailed, appeared originally in ancient Greece as the hedonistic companions of Dionysus in the goatish pan. Later, they became attached to the equivalent Roman gods, Bacchus and Faunus, and evolved the goat-like features that now identify them. Indeed, Michelangelo's horned Moses has sometimes been compared explicitly to them, or a member of the Bacchic entourage. The 18th century Roman art historian Francesco Milizia derided Moses as having a satyr's head with the hair of a pig. While Milizia's mention of pig hair seems apt only to insult the Jewish lawgiver, the horns and beard must be to blame for the satiric association. I suspect that these banal comparisons to goats or satyrs distracted from an indeterminate sense of unease that the horns of Moses continued to arouse. Alexandre Dumas acknowledged the effect of the horns well when he wrote that this emblem of savage energy and animal force adds a certain something, je ne sais quoi, of the strange and redoubtable to the physiognomy of the colossus. Dumas' je ne sais quoi, as much as Simmons' pronounced ambivalence, betrays a feeling related to the horns that might have interested Freud, one that we might describe as uncanny. Curiously, though, Freud ignored the horns entirely in his essay on the statue, and when reminded of them in private correspondence, had only this to say. The misunderstanding out of which arose the horns of Moses has long been known and clarified. It is not the responsibility of Michelangelo, since all representations of Moses before him show the same horns. Thus, I would have no reason to concern myself with this conventional attribute in the discussion of Michelangelo's Moses. With the possible exception of the first statement, everything Freud says about the horns is demonstrably false. Before taking him to task, I should clarify the misunderstanding he mentions and his legacy in Christian tradition. The etymological roots of the horns are to be found in St. Jerome's Vulgate translation of Exodus 34, where Moses descends a second time from Mount Sinai with two new tablets of law. And when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, he knew not that his face was horned from the conversation of the Lord. The Dwayne Rheims Bible, 1609, quoted here, follows Jerome's notorious mistranslation of the Hebrew karen, a verb found nowhere else in the Hebrew Bible whose proper meaning remains obscure, but which probably shares its etymology with the noun keren, meaning cornu, horn. Other vernacular translations, including the King James Version, restore the sense that was probably intended in the Hebrew, the skin of his face shone. Although the horn Moses is a written concept originates in the 2nd century, there is no evidence of an iconographic usage any earlier than the 11th century. Ruth Menikoff has argued that the innovation in England represented the transposition to Moses of an ancient Anglo-Saxon Scandinavian motif implying honour, power and dignity. From England, the horn Moses appears to have spread to the continent and had become commonplace in Northern Europe by the mid-13th century. By this time, a symbolic meaning had also accrued, aligned with St. Augustine's view that the second set of stone tablets, holding which Moses appeared horned, prefigured the New Testament. The horns were understood to symbolise the old law and the new. Curiously, the iconographic usage did not take hold in Italy, but there remained a preference to show the horns as two rays of light. This is an example with which Michelangelo would be very familiar from the side walls of the Sistine Chapel, where Moses, he has two sort of bundles, straw-like bundles, of rays on the sides of his head. Since their emergence as an artistic convention, Moses' horns were not necessarily confined to their place in the biblical narrative, but were employed in general as an identifying attribute. Beyond their convenience as such, the horns have powerful and quite ambivalent connotations. As Melnikoff has shown, they generally had more negative than positive associations in the eyes of medieval Christians. During the Middle Ages, they were used as demonic attributes in art, and imaginary idols are often shown with horns. Since their parents to Judaism were commonly imagined to be idolaters in league with the devil, the horns of Moses could in some cases have been seen as testament to that. Recently, the horns of Moses in general, and those of Michelangelo's statue in particular, have been construed as evidence of Christian anti-Semitism, an anachronism relying on a simplistic conflation of medieval anti-Judaism with modern racism. More often, though, the statue's horns are dismissed in the manner that Freud dismissed them, as a conventional attribute and therefore not Michelangelo's responsibility. These suppositions are shown to be false by two examples that Freud himself cited in his discussion of the Moses pose. One, a painting by Parmigianino in 1535, which shows Moses with three darts of light at each side of his head, which you can just about make out there. The other, a small Romanesque bronze in which Moses' head has no adornments at all. on Freud's own evidence, his assertion that all representations of Moses before Michelangelo show the same horns is manifestly wrong. It's been suggested that Michelangelo's decision to give his figure horns rather than rays of light was due to the constraints of the sculpture medium, that there were other means of representation available. Here's a late 13th century statue of Moses on the left by Giovanni Pisano, where he represents rays, and here there's not a curl of the hair on the side of the brow, which suggests horns or rays. In view of such alternatives, we must accept that the horns of Michelangelo's Moses, which are no mere ciphers but embedded in the figure's anatomy, are no more inevitable in this case than they were conventional in Italian iconography. In short, they are very much the responsibility of Michelangelo. And it's interesting that there's almost no mention of Moses' horns in the literature of Michelangelo's contemporaries. And here, one of his followers, Ammanati, made a very closely observed replica of Moses about the scale, which is correct in every detail except that it has no horns. If Michelangelo's contemporaries were reluctant to acknowledge the horns of his Moses, later commentators were more forthright, including Watkins Lloyd, who Freud claimed had anticipated and confirmed his own interpretation of the statue's pose. While admiring its mystical embodiment of sublimity, Lloyd found it utterly impossible with candor to deny that the head of Moses appertains to the satyr type. You might indulge Lloyd here, since the meaning he gave the satiric aspect of the figure, an aspect he supposed was intentional, leads us to make some important connections. Recalling Michelangelo's humanist education, Lloyd suggested that by adding Bacchic elements to the figure, the artist meant to identify Moses with the Greco-Roman god of wine. And this is true that the identification of Moses with Bacchus was popular in the 16th century. And there's a little horns, panis, seeing these grapes. The connection derives from coincidences in their mythical pre-Christian origins, as well as the type of miracles ascribed to them. As Lloyd notices, Bacchus had a propensity to bring forth springs and fountains of water, wine, or any refreshing form of humidity, milk, honey, etc., by a stroke of his thyrsus and for his following of errant enthusiasts. This description resonates with Moses' miraculous provision of water and manna in the desert, and with God's promise that the followers of Moses would be brought unto a land flowing with milk and honey. Sometimes the errant enthusiasm of Moses' own followers has a distinctly Bacchic flavour, most notably in the adoration of the golden calf, which involved eating and drinking, nakedness and play, which reads as a euphemism for fornication. Egypt, the land from which Moses led the children of Israel, retained a strong imaginary connection with polytheism, and the lure of false gods is described as a constant threat to Moses' authority during the Exodus. The Mosaic religion, which made its one god distinct from false pagan gods, necessarily resisted the typological slippage that occurs in polytheism. Dionysus could become Bacchus or any other god, but Moses supposedly could not. This seemingly clear distinction is confounded in an image of Moses made by the bronze sculptor Andrea Riccio in Padua at around the time that Michelangelo blocked out his own statue in Rome. Riccio's Moses, which reenacts the miraculous striking of water from the desert rock, has the ram's horns of Zeus Ammon, the form in which the Greek god was venerated in Egypt. As the art historian Alexander Nagel remarks, without the inscriptions on the font on which Moses stood that relate the figures of the Mosaic Book of Numbers, there would be no way of proving that this was Moses at all. The two identities, Zeus Ammon and Moses, each fully developed and yet fused. What could have motivated Richard to profane the Mosaic miracle in this way? As Nagel recalls, in the account of striking water from the rock, Moses seems to claim the divine miracle as his own feat of Egyptian magic, and is severely chastised by God, who intimates that he will die before reaching the promised land. Conscious of Moses' unstable identity at this moment, Riccio represents him, according to Nagel, not as a stable type to Christ's antitype, but as he might have appeared to a still superstitious community of Israelites, as a hero invested with special powers who occasionally flickers into recognizability as a crazy deity. In Nagel's words, Riccio's Moses not only looks forward to Christ, but backward to Egypt, the land he is struggling to leave behind, and from whose proliferating divinities he is yet to distinguish himself. Nagel's discussion of Riccio's Moses leads him to describe the idolatrous lapses of the Israelites in terms of a repetition compulsion. He reminds us that the worship of the golden calf has been understood as a reversion to the Egyptian cult of the divine bull, Apis. Nagel, however, declines to take the Freudian path that he signals, the path that leads us inevitably back to Michelangelo Vasari and the fictional image cult of Moses. In the case of both Riccio's and Michelangelo's Moses statues, it is the horns that destabilize the identity of the lawgiver. And in the former case, they readily evoke the idolatrous repetition compulsion of his followers. According to Freud, whatever reminds us of these inner repetition compulsions is perceived as uncanny, the sensation we have already come to associate with Michelangelo's statue. We are perhaps too far removed from Italian Renaissance culture, deeply Christian, but with a deep interest in the pre-Christian, to know how strong was the uncanny effect produced by the horns of either Moses. The distinctive ram horns of Riccio's Moses are clearly intended to evoke Zeus' hammer, but what about the horns of Michelangelo's figure? Duma found them strikingly similar to the emergent horns of a young billy goat, but he might equally have compared them to those of a young ram or a calf. As for their arrangement, they are rooted closer together on the head than it usually occurs in nature, Moses horns. But that only serves to increase their visibility from a frontal view, making them a salient feature of the statue's distinctive silhouette. There are other ways in which the horns of Moses differ from animal archetypes. They tilt slightly forward, and they diverge asymmetrically, the left one being angled sideways. When viewed from directly in front of the tomb, almost as we see it there, the irregularity of the horns is fairly discernible, but when Moses is seen face to face, the effect is visually disconcerting. You can see how this horn on the statue's left seems to follow the direction of that eye. Which is a point I think I made. The arrangement might seem accidental, but it appears less so when read in connection with the figure's eyes. A slight divergence in the alignment of the pupils, the right eye looks almost straight while the left is averted, which reflects on the precise alignment of the horns, suggesting a symbolic dimension related to Moses' sight or even his intellect. This brings to mind the significance of horns that has so far been overlooked in discussions of Moses' iconography. In Italy, since the Middle Ages or earlier, they have been used to stigmatize a betrayed husband, or cuckold. While the cuckold's horns have appeared elsewhere in Europe, they are rooted most deeply in Mediterranean cultures, where the two-fingered horn gesture remains in use today. This might go some way to explaining the scarcity of horns as an attribute of Moses in Italian art. The association may not have been made consciously by Italian roots of Exodus, because the Latin or Italian adjective this feminine form is Cornutha, the first Moses' face. But once translated to a visual medium, Moses becomes literally Cornutha horned. And that was a slur that was commonly prosecuted as libel in the 16th century. Furthermore, beneath the visual and verbal agreement, there lies a deeper analogy between the horns of Moses and those of the cuckold. The Hebrew Bible treats the Mosaic covenant metaphorically as a marriage, uniquely monogamous, between God and Israel. And in terms of this metaphor, idolatry is equated with sexual promiscuity. Time doesn't permit me to elaborate, going on long enough. It's worth noting the potential notoriety of Moses' horns was realized by Michelangelo's contemporary, Pietro Aretino, who was a poet and playwright and sometimes a pornographer. In Aretino's comic play, Cortigiana, Ercolano, the drunken baker, bemoans his wife's extramarital adventures. He who keeps goats will have horns, and I'm not so blinded by wine that I don't see my horns. Following a public rant at his wife, Ercolano receives some sardonic advice from another character, Bellario. Make the best of it and keep your horns visible, for they are worn these days by the greatest of men. Indeed, if you knew your history, you'd know that horns came from heaven, and that Moses wore them for everyone to see. Aretino's mischief is to play on the biblical description of Moses' second descent from Sinai, when he knew not that his face was horned from his conversation with the Lord. Since it was the Vulgate Christian tradition that made horns the divine light, it was Aretino's prerogative to make light of the horns. According to him, it was with his own hand that God adorned the head of Moses, the best friend he had in the Old Testament. A contemporary audience would have known well what is implied by the furtive two-fingered sign, that a beast, or cuckold, cannot see its own horns, while everyone else can. there's reason to suppose that Michelangelo was as mindful of Moses' ignorance with respect to his horns. The statue's twin protuberances, the blunt tips of which point forward over Moses' brow, could even be seen as finger-like. The idea is conjectural, of course, but not preposterous. Innuendo of this sort has its place in Michelangelo's art, and it is conceivable that he played Moses' horns as much as Aretino. We notice that the horns of the statue follow the direction of the eyes, rather like the seeing horns of a snail, while remaining behind and thereby out of Moses' line of sight. These unseen attributes could suggest a higher perception to which Moses is not privy, but which Christian viewers of the statue ought to be. That is, knowledge of the New Testament, which the horns of Moses were sometimes understood to prefigure. It may be difficult to identify the budding horns of the Moses with those of any particular animal, but in choosing an appearance that inclines towards animal naturalism, Michelangelo might have known that they would be seen as bestial attributes. In destabilizing the human anatomy of the figure in this way, the artist left Moses open to a variety of associations and insinuations involving goats, satyrs, horned gods, idols, and even the cuckold. The horn's suggestiveness might underlie the popular idea that Moses' stern countenance reflects the adoration of the golden calf, the arch-idol of Exodus. It's remarkable that Freud, in his essay on Michelangelo's statue, ignored not only the horns, but also Vasari's tale of the Jewish Moses worshippers. Had he acknowledged either, he would have been forced to confront the uncomfortable paradox of the Moses embodies. We know that Freud was aware of what Vasari had written, since he owned a copy of the Lies in German translation, and the passage referring to the Moses anecdote was underlined in its Roman guidebook. If Freud effectively repressed the potential of Moses to become an idol or false god, while continuing to admire the statue under the pretext of scientific inquiry, quite like the hero of Jensen's Incredible, we may fairly expect to see the repressed idea emerge as if by malicious treason. We needn't be disappointed. The first published response to Freud's Moses of Michelangelo was in a volume of psychoanalytic studies on ritual by his pupil Theodor Reich, written in 1919, 5 years after the Moses of Michelangelo. Reich readily entertained the idea that the horns of the Moses derived from a repressed object of worship. In Reich's essay, which is heavily indebted to Freud's Totem and Taboo, published in 1913, he commends Freud's analysis of the Moses while respecting his anonymity as author. Since Freud himself wrote the preface to Reich's volume, as well as shaping much of its content, we must begin to appreciate the fun that he had with the Moses of Michelangelo. According to Reich's Freudian interpretation, Michelangelo recognized the true origin of Moses' horns. They came from an animal, totem god, which Moses himself had destroyed and thereby usurped, appropriating its bestial features. Moreover, Moses and the totem god later replaced in biblical tradition by the higher concept of Yahweh, are both identifiable with the golden calf. In this way, Reich explained the ambivalent effect of Michelangelo's statue, which, oscillating between attraction and repulsion, assumed in the eyes of some the shape of an enormous animal, in those of others the figure of the deity himself. For Reich, the Vulgate and Michelangelo are right. Moses is horned. He bears the symbol of the animal god feared and admired of old in the primitive period. How or to what extent Michelangelo might have shared this realization, Reich does not say. Still, he used the sculptor Moses and his legendary reception to support his own idea that by destroying the totem god, yet identifying himself with it by adopting its horns, Moses became God in its place. If the golden animal which the Jews worship in Exodus is really an image of Moses, the cult of this young animal, which has taken the place of the paternal bull, would correspond somewhat to the adoration of Michelangelo's statue of Moses by the Jews in Rome, as what Reich says. The words of Vasari resonate here. Well, may the Jews go to visit and adore the Moses, since this is not something human, but divine that they adore. We need not even subscribe to Reich's argument to appreciate a connection between the horns of Michelangelo's statue, which he sees as befitting a young bull, and those of the Hebrew's idol. The uncanny effect produced by the re-emergence of the idol's horns in the image of the lawgiver is the mark of what Reich, after Freud, would call the return of the repressed. According to Freud, the uncanny is nothing other than a hidden, familiar thing that has undergone repression and then emerged from it. But can we credit Michelangelo with such a precociously Freudian idea? In fact, we have evidence that Reich, if he had known it, would certainly have claimed to be conclusive. This comes in the shape of a small terracotta figure of Moses, recently attributed to Francesco da Sangallo, who as a child had accompanied Michelangelo to witness the excavation of the Leocon. Although the figure is standing, part of its pose is a direct quotation from Michelangelo's statue. The hand of the muscular right arm resting on the tablets drags snake-like coils of beard across the chest, countering the left turn of the figure's head. The drama of the pose is heightened by the declamatory gesture of the left hand and the figure's upward gaze. From the waist down, however, the effect is altogether different. The legs are arranged in a graceful attitude reminiscent of Donatello's bronze nave David. Just as the foot of the giant killer treads on the severed head of Goliath, this Moses tramples his own archenemy, the golden calf. This triumph, however, is unsettled by a strange yet familiar phenomenon. Making explicit the suggestion of Michelangelo's figure, the horns that emerge from the head of the terracotta Moses are identical to those of the calf beneath his foot. The evocation of Donatello's bronze David is no accident either. The figure was described by contemporaries inspiring fear and love for what he did to overcome Goliath. The latent memory of capital punishment was what inspired the same love and terror in Condivi's characterization of Moses, who killed 3,000 of his followers for their infidelity at Sinai. In the terracotta Moses statuette, the golden calf, an idol decapitated from its own column, takes the place of the head of Goliath, recalling the terrible punishment enacted on the Hebrews. This image, however, confuses the result of the encounter by making Moses an idol in spite of himself. Moses is thus betrayed by his own position of eminence, becoming just like the false gods he sought to destroy, for in the terms of Christ Moses in monotheism, he is revealed as identical with the God of the Jews. A Freudian perception of the horn Moses differs crucially from Reich's, in that for him, Moses knowingly took the place of the calf idol, whereas we, like Michelangelo and the maker of the terracotta figure, are mindful of the biblical account, which says that when Moses came down from Sinai, he knew not that he was horned. In the case of Moses, in fact, the Freudian idea of malicious treason has some basis in biblical tradition. The account of Moses' death in the last chapter of the Pentateuch describes how he was buried by God, so that no man hath known of his sepulchre until the present day. According to exegetical tradition, the occultation of the grave of Moses served to prevent any possibility of a cult of Moses, with pilgrimages to his gravesite. This theme of burial and repression brings to mind Freud's archaeological metaphor, as much as Vasari's idea of pagan idols buried beneath Christian Rome. We're prepared to recognise, as Vasari seems to have done, that an Al-Antica statue of Moses, sitting on the tomb of Moses' Roman Christian antitype, Julius II, provides an ideal setting for the return of the repressed. The idea we've credited to Vasari was elaborated by a 17th century theologian, Giovanni Andrea Borboni, in his discussion of Michelangelo's statue. In his discussion of Michelangelo's statue, Borboni recalls the hiding of Moses' body from the Israelites, suggesting that they, being so dedicated to idolatry, would have worshipped him as their own god. Borboni, like Vasari, was apparently sensitive to the return of the repressed, and even the typical manner of such recurrences. He goes on to elaborate Vasari's claims concerning contemporary Roman Jews. He says, "The Jewish people, while remaining unwilling to witness that the Messiah has come, having been forced to abandon idolatry, would, on seeing the Moses of Michelangelo, bow down to it, as though their liberator from long and hard servitude under Pharaoh and the leader of their ancestors in the promised land were resurrected, and they would readily worship him as their god." According to Borboni's elaboration of the Sari, the Jews effectively rediscovered the body of Moses in the sepulchre of Julius II. He imagines a typological extension, Moses rising from the tomb like Christ, but the effect, while flattering to Michelangelo, is less than flattering to Moses, and still less so to the Jews. The imagined profanity of Moses becoming an incarnate deity in place of the numinous God of the Hebrew Bible is a realization of the duality inherent in Michelangelo's statue. While Vasari and Borboni both saw divine radiance reflected in his polished marble face, their imaginary Jews, like so many irreverent critics, failed to see beyond the horns of the idol. It seems that Michelangelo's statue of Moses, like the Book of Exodus according to St. Paul, has the potential to be read in one way or another, as a relic of ancient Egypt or as a prefiguration of Christ. It might appear as the former to imaginary Jews, or Protestant Judaizers, and as the latter to true Christians, that is, Roman Catholics. In this image, Michelangelo masters the return of repressed paganism and cuckolds the biblical lawgiver, at least in a figurative sense. it might be some consolation to Moses that Michelangelo, in a poem written in old age, would regret the error of a passionate fantasy by which his own divine art became his idol.
Questions. I think we've got a bit of time. I was just thinking, with your kind of explanation, do you still make a connection with the kind of biographical story? I mean, what's going on in Freud's life at the time?
I think he used the opportunity to publish an allegory directed at Jung. I think that what Theodor Reich wrote is that what Freud, in all honesty, would have liked to have written, or would have genuinely written, from a psychoanalytic perspective about Moses.
But how would that connect with the kind of life story? You know, I mean, Freud's writing the history of the psychoanalytic movement at the same time. And Jones gives a kind of motivated explanation of you know, why he has this particular theory about Moses, because he's got, you know, so is there a connection in how you're...
I'm suspicious. I suspect that
Freud... Yeah, it seems too packed.
That Freud did not genuinely believe that he had interpreted the post of Atlantis to Moses, but then it's odd that he revisited it 30 years later. Try to confirm it with reference to this little bronze figurine that has no horns. So it's full of contradictions, and I'm afraid that I'm somewhat confused by Freud's own particular relationship to this statue and to his writing about it. But what I am certain of is that Freud was an influence or collaborator in Reich's interpretation of the horns of Moses, which is an interpretation which is prescribed by the totem and taboo. If you look at a statue of a horn of Moses, with totem and taboo fresh in your mind, it's almost impossible to see it any other way as a feature of a repressed totem.
I'm still trying to think if there's a way of connecting it to, you know, what's going on in Freud's life. That's the only thing. And whether there is any, you know, I mean, even though the Jones explanation seems a bit packed, you know, but is, you know, the way that Freud's looking at the statue and his kind of investment in it, the fact that he's been going to Rome for 12 years, and then, you know, so why now? You know, why now would you start drawing it, measuring, doing, you know, making a theory about it?
He identified very strongly with Moses, and he saw. I think he explicitly told Jung that he regarded him as his Benjamin. You know, Freud was too old to see the Promised Land, but Jung as Benjamin would lead the children of Israel to the Promised Land, and so he felt terribly betrayed by Jung's apostasy in 1913. And I think this essay where he identifies himself with Moses and talks about the restraint of Moses and not dashing the psychoanalytic law to the ground and face of this apostasy, I think it's very much directed at Jung. Otherwise the essay is an aberration in terms of the...
Well, it is an aberration. It's quite...
Yeah. And so I think that... I know that Freud had a very... I mean, Reich was a very devout follower of Freud. And I don't know whether perhaps I didn't know enough about Reich, but perhaps Freud used it as a mouthpiece to issue a corrective for his interpretation of Moses.
Just last one. With the it's just a point of information. I mean, with the 3,000 people that we talked about, realize how does it say how they were killed?
By the Levites. They were ordered to.
But it doesn't give a kind of.
I didn't remember. That's
just this kind of general slaughter. Yeah.
Imagine sort.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for that talk. And I'd like to go back to another aspect of repression, the figure that's been repressed here, or in, at least in this angle on it, is the Pope himself, Julius. Now, I mean, how much, I'm going back from Freud now to the statue itself, how much of that statue do you think, how much does that statue reflect Michelangelo's attitude towards Julius, the Pope? I mean, I think they had quite a stormy relationship.
Yes.
And not yet only his attitude, his ambivalent attitude towards Julius, but perhaps even to religion itself. I mean, you showed a picture from the Sistine Chapel from the roof, and it has a fleeing figure, and you can see its backside.
Yes.
Now, is this the backside of God?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Yes, this is what I thought. Now, surely, I mean, this is almost cartoon, isn't it?
Yes.
It's as if Michelangelo is parodying the Bible and the whole Moses story. Yes.
Yes.
I
think there's...
this is God's backside.
There's probably an allusion to God's back part.
It is,
because,
yes.
Because Moses pleaded with God to show him his face.
Yes.
And God said, no one can see my face and live.
But
if you... Hang on a minute, I'll show you my back parts. Sure. And that's what happened, and that's when Moses was transfigured. But he wasn't allowed the frontal.
I mean, the other aspect of his transfiguration, anybody who sees God must die.
Yeah.
So maybe even seeing his back parts would kill him. And one of the interpretations of the statue's gaze is that Moses is facing his own death.
Yes.
That he must die.
I think that this paper represents probably one way of looking at the statue of Moses, but there are numerous ways, none of which is necessarily exclusively the correct one. I think that it's been also in terms of a self-portrait, that epitomizes Michelangelo himself. I would have liked to have said something about this relationship of Julius, but I was conscious that I'm probably speaking for one half anyway. Yes,
can you say a couple of words?
I think there's something around with that. I'm afraid I haven't got a close-up of the statue, because the Pope, it's often forgotten that the Pope himself does feature in the tomb. There is an effigy of the Pope. And he's this figure here, this reclining figure, and he's actually looking down, his eyes appear closed.
Yeah.
And he has none of that sort of vitality. The Pope was a famously warlike Pope. When Michelangelo made a statue of him in Bologna and suggested perhaps he could be holding a book, the Pope said, rather saw that book. I'm not a man of letters, some such. So I think, yes, I think that in terms of the way that Pope Julius has been certainly mythologized, I think this is probably a truer representation of him than the reclining figure up there. I'm sorry, does that come near to...
There's no single answer, it's just a spoken question.
I think that so much has been made of Moses as a representation of Pope Julius II, that I think it's distracted from other things which are very interesting about the statue, which is which I pursued. But I'm certainly receptive to that idea. There's also the story that there was a cardinal who visited Michelangelo's workshop while he was working with Moses and said, and he said, this figure alone will not be able to, this tomb of Judas. That story fits into this long and tormented history of the tomb that Michelangelo conceived as an impossibly large monument for the St. Peter's and the Vatican. And 40 years later, he produced this, which is seen as being almost cobbled together from what he had at hand. And so the idea that this figure would offer the tomb of Judas is a way of saying, well, it's a way of vindicating Michelangelo in a way.
I just wanted to say that I thought it was very interesting that you, I mean, parallels between, you know, the element of self-representation, the farcical and the tragic, all those poetic sensibilities that Michelangelo has, when he mocks himself, when he has this sort of tragic conception of his own destiny, you sort of feel it in the evocation of the Moses, and I thought it was particularly interesting that you drew comparisons with this, as you say, therapeutic, but also dramatic confrontation with the excavation of the lacoon, because there are parallels between that and the Moses story. It's a perception of a promised land, but also a lost golden path. Yeah. It's a what can come after such perfection, but failure in a sense. You know, when Moses is there, and for me, it's not really a question, but I wanted to thank you for that very pertinent parallel.
Thank you for elaborating.
Can I add to your point about what a nice comparison it is between the Laocoon and the Moses? Because also I wondered whether you thought the subject of Laocoon, the high priest, has anything to say to the figure of Moses.
I have thought about that. The fact that he's the victim of a divine punishment. I think that there's some confusion about actually what it was that he did wrong. And the same is true of Moses. And then there's the episode of the venomous serpents, which figures in the story of Moses, when the children of Israel are being persecuted by serpents, but God is sent to punish them for their apostasy. Moses who saves them with a graven image of the serpent, which is prescribed by God.
That's what I was wondering, whether it might be at stake in that, because you showed that your fantastic Francesco da San Gallo terracotta, and it's extremely serpentine than in the Michelangelo, which somehow brought Laocoon back for me.
Yeah, it's a different kind of beard. In fact, it's much more.
There's also an introduction of that sort of almost grotesque introduction of a mannerist effeminacy, throwing back to Donatello the lower part of the body, which is very peculiar.
It is, and I think it's a very deliberate paraphrase. In fact, it's a very extraordinary figure, and it's. I don't know where it is. It's in the private collections.